Fastam Eye. Good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. On the programme tonight, is planning enforcement across the island improving? A committee hears evidence from the DEFA minister, who thinks it is, Douglas Council, which thinks it isn't, and MHKs, who are unsure on the subject, and a report which could lead to fundamental reforms of the Manx NHS is published. We hear from Sir Jonathan Michael. The Tynwald Inquiry has heard how public trust in government's commitment to enforce planning laws will improve with better communication. The Environment Minister, Geoffrey Boot, made that claim last Friday whilst giving evidence to the Environment and Infrastructure Policy Review Committee. He says enforcement is now a priority for his department where previously it hadn't been, with new resources in place to ensure all breaches are investigated. I asked Mr. Boot why he thought engagement on this issue was important.
Communication is key to engaging with the public, and I think we made the point that we want to engage at the same time as demonstrating that there is obviously an increased enforcement force available and resource there. Around 25% of the department's planning officers are engaged in some form of enforcement, and that wasn't the case a few years ago. We are obviously serious about enforcement, but we don't like to see people as the enemy. We like to work with them, and that's the communication theme here, I think.
And have the public in the past perhaps seen the enforcement department at planning as the enemy for not perhaps doing what they perceive to be their jobs?
Well, planning is a very complex process. There are winners and losers every time the planning process starts. So you're always going to end up with one section disillusioned or believing that they've been wronged. Part of our job is to try and tell people why they've not got the result they want, or what they thought was happening has happened, but it happened behind the scenes and they didn't know about it. And this is often what happens in planning. Enforcement takes a long time for complex cases, 2, 3, sometimes 4 years. And people think that we haven't done anything when in actual fact we have. So that's part of educating the public as to what we're doing. Also working with local authorities, I think, as we talked about during the hearing, is important, because local authorities are at the front line and people often complain to them. So if they come to us and we're able to explain what's going on and they know what we're going to do, that helps the whole process.
Slightly uneven though, the local authority scene, because you have some authorities that can afford a full-time planning officer, others who have a clerk on 2 days a week. So it's not quite an even playing field for them.
It isn't, and obviously expertise and resource is sometimes key. But I don't think I want... I'm not talking about planning being perpetrated by local authorities. I'm talking about an understanding of the process, so that when someone walks through the door and says, this is happening, do you think that's an enforcement issue? They then talk to the department and our resource is then available to them, and then we take the case on or not. If we explain that it's not going to be an issue, that we will take action on.
DEFA Minister Geoffrey Boot. Well, representatives of Douglas Council also gave evidence at the inquiry and claimed problems with effective planning enforcement came down to one thing, a lack of resource. Let's hear this extract of the committee where Councillor Richie McNichol, Director of Environmental Services Mrs. Dana Enyon, and Dilapidation Officer Stephen Slater gave their views.
I personally believe that the resources that they have and the number of officers that are dealing with enforcement matters isn't sufficient to be able to tackle all of the problems that we've noticed, and that's just within the Douglas area.
Could I just ask you to what degree these examples, I'm looking at it very much from a generic perspective, are historic? Because I think the department this morning were very clear that they fully recognised that there was a quality performance deficit historically, and that's fully acknowledged, but they are now trying to fix that problem and explained how they were trying to do it. So it would be helpful if we could understand in broad terms, are these very recent or somewhat historic?
In the submission we gave, one of the examples was a historic case.
Right.
But the other examples we've given this morning are, we would call them recent cases. Almost. So, for example, one of the car parks we talked about, and we are avoiding naming areas. One of the car parks we talked about was granted permission in 2015, and that expired in 2017. The other example we gave is one we brought to their attention in April 18. So they had until April of 19 to take action, and we understand no action's been taken. So I think that is quite recent.
Can I, just to give an overview, because I think it's, we're dealing with a local authority now, which is completely different from the submissions that we've received from most individuals, which are individual cases. Again, clearly they've said there was a lack of response, slow to take action, policy wasn't fit for purpose, delay in dealing with complaints, lack of engagement, lack of communication, updates, and an inconsistency in the approach undertaken by the department. I think you've already highlighted some of that, but you say you have a positive relationship. Can I ask you to explain that? Because by the sound of it, it sounds like maybe a local authority, especially the size of Douglas, should have more enforcement powers given its size and the man and the staff available to help the department.
Sorry, on an officer level, we have a good working relationship with our colleagues in planning and also enforcement. We made the point in our submission that we do have difficulty getting hold of them sometimes, and we do have difficulty getting responses. So we have said that in our submission, but when we do speak to them, they are helpful. So what we don't want to do is come across as criticising our colleagues. We're not criticising our colleagues. We really believe it's a resource issue. We didn't make comment in our submission about the policy. We understand we had an enforcement officer come into the council and give a presentation, and she explained the policy that was followed about prioritising, and I think the council members understood that. They understood the priorities. But obviously there aren't enough people to deal with all of the cases that are being brought forward, and some of those are then having unintended consequences for us as a local authority, for the communities that we serve, but in turn then for us as a local authority.
It is obviously a resource issue, because they have 12 months in which to go through the process of that enforcement, and that's not happening. So I think it's a theme throughout our submission that resources are desperately needed down there.
That was Councillor Richie McNichol, Director of Environmental Services Mrs Dana Enyon, and Dilapidation Enforcement Officer Stephen Slater. Three of the MHKs who signed a letter to ask the committee to investigate the issue also appeared at the inquiry. I spoke to Dr Alex Allenson, Daphne Kane and Laurie Hooper after they gave evidence.
The rationale behind sending the letter was basically off the back of a number of issues with constituents where they were planning issues hadn't been enforced, or there were really kind of some pretty surreal decisions taken by planning officers during the planning process. And then the Tynwald Commissioner for Administration had tabled a report about a particular issue that he was investigating or been asked to investigate, and some of the comments in that report from October really did resonate with a lot of the concerns. No appeal process, no transparency, no KPIs, no timelines for enforcement, seemingly inconsistent application of enforcement, and really it kind of sparked this, well, how do you raise these issues? Because every time Mrs Kane specifically has tried raising planning issues on the floor of the House of Keys, the response from the Minister has been, we don't talk about planning issues on the floor of the House of Keys because we don't talk about individual cases. So there has to be a way somehow of contextualising those individual cases and trying to see, is there a wider problem? And so it seems sensible to write a letter to the Environment Committee saying, will you investigate this? Will you pick this up as part of your policy remit? And so when I drafted the letter, I thought, well, it's not just me that's got these concerns, there's a number of other MHKs as well. So I gave everyone the opportunity to sign up to it, and I think five or six MHKs did. And obviously three of us are now here today talking to the committee about some of the detail.
Well, Mrs Kane, you did have the chance to sneak in some specific cases. If you could summarise the crux of what the most important evidence you were giving there, what would you say to the public? What's the most important thing you were trying to say in that committee hearing?
I think what we want to see is consistency, and that's not what we're seeing in the matters that are raised with us. The particular case, which is now concluded, was a 6-foot wooden fence replacing a 6-foot wooden fence. 3 years, I think, and additional costs of £5,000 to the householder simply to fight the case, to take it to appeal, although she should get the appeal fee back. It's not everybody who would be able to afford that level of consultation and expertise, and there shouldn't be the need. It should be a fair system, an open system, and decisions should be consistent, and that's hopefully what will come out. If any changes to policy need to be brought, that will hopefully come out from the committee's investigation.
Do you believe the new policy actually encourages some people at a low level not to comply with the law?
Not necessarily. I think we need to give the new policy a bit of chance to work. One of the things that we stressed when we were talking to the committee was that with planning policy, people have to trust it and believe in it and respect it. And because of the what seems like the arbitrary nature of some of this enforcement, I think some of that trust and respect has been lost. So that I think there is a danger that people think, well, there's no point in putting in the planning application because nobody will notice, and if they do, you can do it retrospectively, and if you don't do that, then it won't be enforced. And I suppose what Laurie Hooper has said is very true, that from a constituency point of view, I've seen people who have complained about something that's been erected without planning permission where nothing has happened, but also people who have felt that the policy has been applied overzealously and they've been told to take down a wall or take down a fence when there's been no significant problem with it at all and there's been no impact on other people. So I think, as Mrs. Kane was saying, it's very important to have that fairness and for people to trust the system. And I hope that this new process they've brought in will instill that trust.
Will consistency gain that trust? Or what is the key to gaining that trust?
In terms of the retrospective applications, I think the other example I gave, the suggestion from Ms. Bettison, was that when somebody is impacted by a development that has not had planning approval, the ability for the surrounding householders to detail the impact on them and what level that is would be very important. That would be a big step forward, I think, in people feeling that their views are listened to. But the issue is that while people who haven't got planning approval are encouraged to put in for retrospective planning approval, the offending development is still in situ, and that's a big issue for people.
I think the fact that a lot of these decisions are taken behind closed doors and not a lot of information is available to the public, even people that are going through the complaints process or the enforcement process, it's not always fully informed. And one of the reasons that we tend to trust our normal everyday planning process is because nearly all of that is done in public. And so a lot of the decisions that are taken, it's all public. You've seen the reasons behind it, the rationale behind it. You've got the opportunity to comment. But when it comes down to the enforcement action, that isn't the same at all. And so if the department, for whatever reason, decides either to enforce or not to enforce, there isn't a process whereby you can see, well, how have they acted in the past in similar cases? Can I appeal that decision? Can I get some more information out of them? It's very much a closed door, a closed loop system. And I think one of the key ways to rebuild trust and to make sure everyone has faith in that system is to make sure that when these decisions are made, there's a clear rationale given. Everyone knows why these decisions are made and can see that, no, it is consistent. And, okay, maybe I didn't get the answer that I wanted this time, but at least you can accept that the system itself is a fair system and is being applied consistently.
Isn't that what the new criteria for prioritising work is supposed to do, though?
I think that was possibly the aim of the policy. I'm not convinced that's what it's actually doing in reality. I think when they're classifying things as low priority or very low priority, there it seems to be almost, well, if it's at that level, we're definitely not going to enforce. And I think that's the wrong attitude to be taking. The presumption should be we will enforce unless it doesn't make sense not to, whereas it seems at the moment the presumption is we will not enforce unless there's a very good reason to enforce. And it's about changing that emphasis around to say, well, yes, we expect everyone to comply with planning law, and the main output from any enforcement system should be compliance. You know, no one's out to punish people. What you're trying to do is say, we have a planning system, let's make sure everyone uses it. And if that seems to be where I think the gap is at the moment, it's that emphasis is in slightly the wrong place. So rather than saying, let's try and get everyone to comply, it almost seems like they're drawing a line under certain types of planning issues and saying, we're not going to enforce these, we're not going to try and force people to comply. And that's when you start getting an inconsistent approach, and that's when you start getting people questioning the value of the whole system and actually, should I bother with planning at all? So it is about rebuilding that trust. The policy, maybe it is a small step in the right direction. It's good to see some of this stuff written down and codified, but it does need a lot more work.
Don't those policy decisions then reflect the amount of resource available to the department to do planning enforcement, though?
Well, they do, you're quite right, but that shouldn't be used as an excuse. You shouldn't be able to get away with annoying your neighbours, annoying your local community, just because there's nobody there employed to enforce that. We have rules, we have laws for a good reason. And without that enforcement, those laws sometimes become meaningless. And I suppose that's why we've asked the committee to look into this. If it is that the department need more resources to implement their policy and to make sure that it's carried out, then I'm quite happy for those new, more resources to be provided. Yeah. But it has to be fair that everyone abides by the same rules on the RMM.
And just finally, you mentioned local authorities, Mrs. Kane, and the role they could play in this. Do you see greater scope for their involvement?
That would be if the centre couldn't cope with the volume of cases that they have. But there's also an argument to say that the local authority has more of the community knowledge and might be the best people to determine if there's a dispute, for instance, the planning and advising this fence should be 3 foot high, not 6 foot high. Instead of that going all the way to appeal when it's a domestic matter, perhaps there could be an intervention of common sense at a local level.
I mean, there's also the whole issue of permitted development. So an awful lot of things that have to go through planning, should they? Could they be dealt with at a local level? Should they just be permitted anyway?
And that could change in the upcoming legislation, I believe.
I hope so. I mean, certainly within this administration, I think there's a lot of people who want less bureaucracy, less paperwork, more freedom for people to live their lives without hindrance by government. The government should be there to help, not get in the way of development. And so certainly decent permitted developments with the ability to appeal and with the ability when they've overstepped the mark to enforce correction, I think is very important.
The appeal process, the lack of appeal process for enforcement, is that an issue that needs to be addressed at all, or would that be an extra layer of bureaucracy?
No, it's almost certainly an issue, because if you know why a decision's been made and you've got confidence that decision was the right decision, then that whole system then has a much stronger foundation. And one of the best ways of doing that is to ensure that there is an open, transparent appeal process. One of the comments that was brought up in there was, is there already seems to be an informal appeals process through the complaint system. Complain to MHK, complain to the department, and they'll maybe have a rethink about the decision that was made. So it's wrong that appeals process isn't a formal, proper route that everyone has access to. So yeah, if you're going to make decisions that are going to impact on people, they definitely should have the ability to make you question that decision and say, is that right? Are you sure that was the right decision? And let people actually have their say like they would through the normal everyday planning process. It makes no sense at all why the department can make these decisions and then there isn't an ability then for someone to go back and challenge that decision and say, are you absolutely certain that was the right call?
MHK's Laurie Hooper, Daphne Kane and Dr. Alex Allenson. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. An overhaul of the island's health system, which has become systematically complacent, but with scope for exciting opportunities. That's a snapshot of the views of Sir Jonathan Michael, who's published his long-awaited independent review into the island's health provision. After a year of investigating, Sir Jonathan has 26 recommendations, none of which work in isolation, but together, and all 26 have been unanimously supported by the Council of Ministers. Alex Wadden spoke to him, first of all, about his recommendation that a new structure, suggestibly called Manx Care, should be implemented.
It is urgent that people sign up to and implement them, but actually the implementation is a long-term programme. There are things that can be done, you know, quite quickly and quite readily to improve services and improve efficiency, but actually the totality of the programme is one which will need to run over a number of years. So I'm not saying that things are immediately urgent, but they are necessary.
Is it urgent then the process, the transformation process, starts as quickly as possible though?
Absolutely, because I think, you know, one of the things that I've understood from talking to quite a lot of staff within the service is actually they are looking to this report, you know, as a catalyst for change, you know, the stimulus for the change that they recognise they need and is needed in the service. And so I think it's very urgent that, or urgent in one sense, important that the government signs up to the recommendation, and hopefully Tynwald does, and then they get started on the process of implementation.
We've got full support from the Council of Ministers already, and from talking to people within the health and care system that's currently in place, you said there's appetite for it then?
Absolutely, I think there is, and I think people are looking for, you know, the authority, they're looking to be empowered to get on and improve things. They need to be supported, however.
So each recommendation kind of only works with the other ones as well. None of them really work in isolation. And one of the key points mentioned quite early on is Manx Care, so named. That could obviously change. But can you explain broadly what that means and how it differs from what's currently in place?
Basically, the establishment of a separate organisation that is responsible for delivering care. At the moment, the structure is that the delivery of care and the development of government policy all sit within the same body, the Department of Health and Social Care. And what I'm proposing is, in fact, there should be a separation. So you have the Department of Health and Social Care developing policy and overall strategy as based as part of the government strategy, but you have a separate organisation which is responsible for the delivery of both healthcare and social care. And for those services that that organisation doesn't deliver itself, it is responsible for commissioning, i.e. effectively buying from others those services. And that may be services that are provided on island, or it may be services that are provided off island.
And is this part of the effort that you sort of mentioned as well, that government can often get intertwined somewhat in sort of clinical decision making?
Yes, I mean, it is very difficult if politicians feel under pressure from members of the public, constituents and so on and so forth, to try and influence, you know, prioritisation or treatment programmes and things like that. And by having a formal separation, you know, I think that, to be quite honest, makes it easier for politicians as well.
And the public, perhaps.
Well, I would hope so, yes. It doesn't mean that people can't raise issues of concern, or you know, if they feel their priority is not being recognised, their urgency is not being recognised, but they then have to take that through to the organisation responsible for the care, and they can be supported by a politician in doing that, but the accountability rests with the organisation, not with the politician.
To pick up a couple of the sort of key points, because there's a number of changes that would come into place should this happen as quickly as it said it would be. One of which is a sort of 24-hour frontline service, which currently is in place, so that Nobles and A&E doesn't become the default position. How would that work?
Well, basically, urgent and emergency care on the island needs to be integrated. The moment there is a out of hours GP service, you know, which works, you know, or, you know, in various ways as the A&E department, you know, and there's the ambulance service. This is a population of 85,000. You need an integrated urgent and emergency care service for the island, and that then links into the ability, when people are acutely ill or seriously injured, to be able to transfer them off the island more readily, because that allows you to plan services more carefully.
This report's been looked at. You've been here, of course, looking at this for 12 months, more than 12 months now. Despite a number of issues that you see with the system, have you seen things change in that time?
Yes, I mean, I think inevitably the process of discussion with people, sharing ideas, talking to them, what I've seen is things beginning to improve and things being moved forward, you know, encouragingly over the last 12 months. So that, you know, that's just as a result of the process of talking to people. Hopefully now that the report comes out, that'll give people the ammunition, maybe that's too strong a word, but you know, the areas and the information that they need in order to take this forward. But as I said, it's going to take time. It's not a quick fix, and it'll need support in order to make the transformational changes I'm talking about.
Well, touching back on that support again, certain things that may make people more concerned or maybe hurried to act quickly is statements that you made earlier, such as this system here reminded you somewhat of the NHS in the 1980s. Is that something that might shock people?
Well, it was an organisational structure which was reminiscent to the what I see is the ability to quickly move to what I think, you know, the NHS in England is now belatedly trying to move to, which is the sort of totally integrated service delivery model that the island has been aiming for. I think that the island can jump from where they are now to that fully integrated health and care system in one jump, whereas the NHS has been doing it in short leaps, you know, over the last 30 years.
That's an opportunity that, again, you said there's a number of opportunities here. That would be somewhere the island could maybe make its mark.
Absolutely. I think this is not this is an opportunity to develop an exemplar, to show other people, other island communities, other systems, actually how it can be done.
Another one of the key points you talked about is an air bridge. This is something that would be quite an interesting way to sort of save money in the long term, but maybe cost us a bit more at the moment, would be to improve the air link, essentially, from emergency care from the island to hospitals across.
Yes, one of the ability to move seriously ill or seriously injured people quickly is important. You see this with the Manx Grand Prix. You know, here during that time, you know, there is a helicopter sitting outside Nobles. the ability to move people faster and more efficiently, and indeed safely, when they need treatment off-island is fundamental, A, to the care of the people that are acutely ill, but also to allow them the service delivery model, you know, who does what where, to be defined. If you have to wait 48 hours to get transferred to another provider off-island, then it means you've got to have a different level of service and capability on the island, or you have a lower quality of care. And I don't think that people on the island want to have a lower quality of care.
What priorities should be prioritised here? Is it, you know, recommendation one comes first? The timeline you mentioned is about 4 to 5 years. Should this go ahead as quickly as possible? What should be the first step?
Well, recommendation one is largely around a principle. People signing up to the principle of making sure that the patient or the service user is at the forefront and the centre of planning and service delivery, rather than it being the patient being the passive recipients of a care that is decided without any discussion or consultation. So that's an easy principle for the government to sign up to. The rest of it is a package of changes, all of which need to be taken forward. I've outlined the sort of implementation plan that I think would be necessary, but that's only an outline. It would have to be worked through in detail, and that's going to take a bit of time.
Are you optimistic from the feedback you've had so far that this is going to be implemented as quickly as possible?
Yes, I am. I'm optimistic because of my discussions with staff across the whole system.
Sir Jonathan Michael speaking there to Alex Watton. Well, that's all from tonight's programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda next week, and you can listen again to this episode online as a podcast. But for now, Gurumayu, and have a good evening.